So our customer tends to be 2-3 generations removed from production agriculture, and rightfully so. They're going to have some questions about what we do on the farm gate scenario. And so sometimes if we don't actively portray technology utilization effectively, okay, it can be portrayed really negatively. And we see some challenges in the U.S. We see some challenges when we're trying to sell that product. We see a greater demand for what we call credence attributes now. Those credence attributes, they tend to run towards our animal raising production, our different production systems, okay? I'm sure y'all have seen beef raised without hormones and beef raised without antibiotics in the retail case. So between 2009 to 2012, meat raised without antibiotics was the fastest growing meat market opportunity. Okay, what does this mean for us, okay, as cattle producers? Well, you know, we are at the face of opportunity with trying to create more protein for a growing world population with less land. We have customers in other countries particularly that have a greater purchasing power for protein, okay? This means, and I've borrowed the Elanco figure here, that's been estimated, we're going to need a 70% more technology efficiency options to use on our operations to be able to feed folks, okay? So on the other end of the scale, we have a clientele, okay, that's demanding to know where their food comes from. And that's great, but with that, as mentioned, there can be some pushback. And so how we effectively portray what we're doing on farm is really important, okay? Not only does it affect our customers in purchasing beef, but it affects our global trade markets too, okay? There are countries like Europe, for example, okay? We have pushback on hormones. We know this. So what this leaves us in the face of sustainability is at a dichotomy to make decisions, okay? The producer has to decide between economical decisions, environmental or social aspects that may lend to some marketing opportunity. And so a question that I had in pursuit of my PhD was, how can we more effectively market all beef while improving consumer trust, okay, and transparency? So before we dive into that, I want to take a step back and talk about what's really required on a meat label, okay? Some fundamentals. The product name, the inspection legend, the address line, net weight or quantity, and the ingredient statement. So the product name does have to be accurately defined, and FSIS does have that jurisdiction to do so. And so here's a simple example between ground beef and hamburger and their adequate descriptions for describing that product. We also have the inspection legend and establishment number here. Essentially, that inspection legend assures between state and federal packing facilities. It gives that customer the satisfaction or to know that that product is safe to eat. And then also this establishment number ties back to the plant at which it was processed. And so that's a method of traceability that we do have installed. Then the address line. Here's an example of Frank Beef Company in Massachusetts, but the address line must include the name and the address of either the processor or the distributor of that product. The net weight or quantity statement here is also going to be displayed, and that can vary slightly. For example, if there is some moisture loss of the product or if there's a difference in the weight of that labeling material, but it's going to be really close to 16 ounces. And then for the ingredient statement, there are some provisions. Ingredients need to be listed in the order of the amount that they are used. If there's less than 2% of an ingredient, you can state that it contains less than 2% of such. General terms such as spices or seasonings, those are allowable for proprietary information that an entity may be using. Also, allergen statements, really important. There's 8 major allergens here. Those must be listed, and this is the number one reason for meat recalls. So really important. Other label features can include nutrition information, except for raw products with only one ingredient, and then also handling statements if we need to keep that product cold, frozen, refrigerated, make sure that it's safe to eat, as well as the safe handling instructions that I'm sure you're very familiar with seeing. So, okay, so what else is on the label? Okay, this is when it gets really exciting, right? This is the branded mecca, right? Okay, this is marketing. So these are just a few examples of different branded beef programs, but I want to take a moment and ask, who regulates this turkey ranch? Who regulates that these turkeys are free to forage on a holistic farm? Okay. So I want to touch on misbranding. Misbranding is an issue. We want to avoid misbranding. There are consequences. Okay, rescinding the use of the label, recall, press release, basically public shaming, criminal prosecution, inspection, suspension, or withdrawal, okay, in severe, severe cases. So a little bit more about regulation. Okay, so USDA FSIS regulates products containing 2% or more cooked meat and 3% or more raw meat, whereas FDA regulates meat-flavored sauces and soups and products with less than 2% meat. So in this case, an example, the Tony's cheese pizza would be regulated by FDA containing less than 2% meat, whereas Tony's pepperoni pizza would be regulated by both as it contains 2% or more cooked meat. So here's simply an organizational chart as we begin to proceed more about meat marketing. And so FSIS does have jurisdiction in meat marketing as well as Ag Marketing Service, who you may be more familiar with as a producer, particularly if you're raising feedlot cattle or retaining ownership and you're selling those cattle on a grid-based system. You're going to be getting paid for grading prime, okay, grading choice, et cetera, over select, for example. So AMS does offer us tools for value-based marketing. Certification here is also conducted. An example of that is Very Tender or Tender Claims. If you've ever seen a Safeway steak, Safeway is a great participant, and Very Tender was part of that work as a master's student. Verification programs. Some of our export markets have required USDA process verification, and again, that's a little bit of assistance with traceability. Okay? All right. So, how do we get marketing information on a label? Okay. So, there is an office in Washington, D.C., which houses FSIS labeling and program delivery staff. Those folks are going to oversee animal raising claims. They're going to evaluate labels, publish guidance, and verify that they are in compliance. And if you go online, you can find this. But this is just some simple guidance for those animal raising claims, okay? And I want to show you some examples here. These are generically approved claims. So by the meaning of generically approved, a FSIS inspector on site can approve the use of this marketing that likely you've seen some of these. If it's oven roasted, handcrafted, 100% pure, these are very general items. So there are special statements and claims, and those tend to relate more to on-farm production practices, for example, breed claims, some certification claims, natural claims. The point is here that special statements and claims, they have to actually have a label sketch that's written, and there's further paperwork that follows this, and they must be submitted to the labeling and program delivery staff for review. So aside from the discussion of fake meat, okay, I was hoping y'all would laugh, consumers would trend towards natural and clean labels. We're seeing more pressure to have a clean, natural label in the retail case. But to do so and to have this marketing network applied, FSIS is going to review the labeling and program delivery staff. They are going to review that sketch and to make sure that the company, okay, the entity that owns the product or made the product, provides their definition. Okay, the company verifies, has a mechanism to verify their compliance, and that definition is provided on the label or simply a website. A link to a website can be applied on that packaging, where a customer can then go forward and look more about how that product was produced. Okay. Here's a few examples. You've probably seen some of these. So these are some raising conditions. In the case of poultry, cage-free, we've got free-range, pasture-range, for example. Raised without antibiotics, we've already touched on that. Raised without hormones and growth hormones. Poultry has special provisions for that, as those are not allowed in poultry, even though it's used as a marketing option for them. So it must stay on the package. Federal regulations prohibit the use of hormones in poultry products. Also, diet. We're seeing some diet claims. More recently, grass-fed was withdrawn as a original definition. And so now grass-fed and natural, producers or the owner can have their own definition. And if that is complies with the sketch needs and those requirements previously mentioned, then that can create some flexibility for different owners. And you're probably seeing some of that now. Okay, so I'm going to ask you, can you identify the claim on this package? Anybody? How do you identify the claim? What follows the claim? Look for the asterisk. Anybody? Humanely raised. Yep. Humanely raised is the claim preceded by this statement here. The statement is used to describe the claim. They could use a website link if they choose, but in this case, they described it here. So we've just talked a lot about how to get marketing on a label. Let's talk about what we know in regard to some research. I had the privilege during my master's degree to work on a national checkoff study to identify U.S. consumer preferences for beef flavor. We can see here on the y-axis the shares of preference, and the x-axis we have eight different types of beef. The point of why I put this up here is I wanted to show that we've been able to deduct what the proportion of preference is. And the difference here is denoted by the difference in the shaded bars. But we can see breed, quality grade, wet versus dry aging, and grass-fed all have differences in preference. So we've been able to determine that flavor does impact palatability preference by various consumers across the U.S. And further, we've been able to identify, based upon demographics, some of those preferences. So, for example, domestic grass-fed beef, what we found is that baby boomers, those persons 50 years of age or older, they preferred domestic grass-fed beef 7% more than other age demographics. We also found that upper two-thirds choice dry age beef was preferred on by about 5% higher by baby boomers in comparison to other generations. Now, why? Okay, that's a question I think we could all have a discussion on. But here's a speculation. Maybe those persons grew up with a back 40 and an animal in their backyard and are a little more familiar with grass-fed beef and dry aging beef out of their barn, for example. So that's just a little speculation, But I want to now transition into thinking back about some of the demands for credence attributes based upon our production systems. And so would systems using different levels of growth promoting technology influence consumer preference if they knew the trade-offs and the environmental outcomes and the efficiencies that we have on our operations? So to do this study, I'm very thankful for several different collaborators, and several are in the room, but we came up with the influence of production systems on animal performance, carcass characteristics, environmental impacts, and consumer preferences for beef. So we started this study back in 2015, and we used 120 Angus Simmental crossbred steer calves. We stratified them to treatment. We did that pre-weaning. So we ended up having four different treatments to represent four different production systems. Our first treatment here is NA, which is no technology utilized. That's our control. That's emulating raised without antibiotics. Our second treatment is NHTC, non-hormone treated beef, which is allowed to be fed Tylenol and Remensin. I'll classify these treatments as being raised with lower levels of technology use throughout this presentation. The third treatment is implant, which is the same as two, plus administered three successive implants, pre-weaning, row grow, backgrounding phase, Revelor IS, and the finishing phase here, Rev 200. Then our final treatment is implant plus beta agonist, treated the same as number three, plus fed Optiflex 45 at a low dose, 31 days prior to harvest. So these treatments three and four, I'll classify as our higher levels of growth promoting technology use throughout this presentation. All right. So just to go back a little bit more about the materials and methods of how this product and project really came to fruition. So we were out in Buffalo, South Dakota, and that's where our calves were weaned. We then transported them to Phillip, South Dakota, where they were backgrounded. Then we finally moved them on to the finishing segment. We moved them to North Platte, Nebraska. We collaborated with UNL to do that. We put them in their GrowSafe system. They were on four consecutive step-up diets over a period of 65 days. Their final diet was a 63 mcal diet. We determined to harvest them based upon fat thickness. The reason why we did that is because we're meat scientists, but we really want our cattle to be consistent. We wanted to be basically like procurement from Tyson or Cargill, for example. We're really wanting our cattle to have a consistent fat cover when we go to send them to the plant. So we followed them on to Lexington, Nebraska, where we worked with Tyson, and then we collected carcass data there. And we also simultaneously worked with Dr. Rotz at USDA ARS and utilize the Integrated Farm Systems model, which is a simulation tool to be able to estimate the environmental impacts from the cow-calf segment to the consumer segment, really to the carcass weight basis. So from that prediction model, we were able to gather energy use, water use, nitrogen loss, and then also the carbon footprint. And I'll explain that a little bit more. All right. So just to share a little bit of animal performance data, as we'd expect, the higher levels of growth promoting technology resulted in about 110 pounds on average greater final body weights in comparison to our lower levels of technology here as indicated in blue and yellow. So we would expect this, and this mirrored, of course, onto carcass weight. There's about 87 pounds difference here between our higher levels of growth promoting technology use that we see for those two treatments in the white and striping bars. And then from this carcass weight data, we use that into our life cycle assessment, again, back to the Integrated Farm Systems model. And this is a unique analysis, so I'm going to take a moment to try to share all the information on the slide. But for this comparison, you have to have your control. And so everything here is relevant to NA, or raised without antibiotics. And we have these bars to indicate carbon footprint, the gray bar, again, really important for predicting the carbon emission and methane. And so that's expressed in per kilograms of carcass weight. The energy use is important when we think about kind of yardage. We think about the amount of electricity that we use. And so again, based upon a per carcass weight basis, the water use. When we did this analysis, thought it was really interesting because we learned that the amount of water use that cattle actually intake is about 2% of the total amount of water use. The rest is irrigation-based to derive the feedstuffs to feed the cattle. Okay. Reactive nitrogen, we know that's important for ammonia and potential of nitrogen runoff and algae blooms and water quality. So that's why we decided to predict for that outcome. What you see here between these two higher levels of growth promoting technology use is they're on this negative scale relative to NA. And what that means is that overall, they were both more efficient and had less environmental impacts in comparison to NA. Now, some of you may be asking, why is implant plus beta agonist not more efficient? Okay. And again, if we go back to how we harvested these cattle, we harvest them again to a constant fat thickness. It took this treatment 18 more days to get to the packing plant, okay? And because of that, it just simply reduced the efficiency, okay, in this analysis. Now, NHTC a little bit more intermittent in comparison to NA, but we see carbon footprint and water use being reduced. Again, that's Tylan and Rumensin, okay? All right, so I'm going to share with you a little bit about our meat quality analyses and outcomes. We did see, as you'd expect, a deduction in degree of marbling for higher levels of growth promoting technology use that resulted in low choice in comparison to average choice. We also saw some advancements here in skeletal maturity or degree of skeletal maturity for implant plus beta agonist, like we would expect, but this is still all immaturity. Okay. Percent lipid, again, that mirrored our marbling score, and oppositely, moisture followed. So this made sense to us. I'd like to share with you now the influence of these production systems on meat tenderness, how we evaluate meat tenderness on a quantitative basis in meat science. Has historically been quite a bit on Werner-Bratz or shear force in kilograms. And what we see here are all four treatments at a value less than 3.0. Okay? We can claim that certified tender is 4.4 kilograms or less, and very tender, I believe, is 3.9. So with that, you can see that all four of our treatments could have been USDA AMS certified tender easily. But I'll go ahead and share, So our higher levels of growth promoting technology use did result in about 1.3 pounds more pressure to be able to slice that steak relative to our lower technology use. Okay? And we'd expect that. But I think hold on to that memory when we get into the consumer part because our consumers were able to pick that up. Okay? All right. So continuing on to the third chapter, or essentially the third manuscript of this study, want to talk about the consumer analysis. We used iPads just for greater efficiency. We use Qualtrics. It's a model to help us emulate the format to work through our consumer panel. We cook steaks consistently to a medium degree of doneness and ensured that they were maintained at an adequate temperature prior to serving. We worked with a professional company called Food Perspectives in Plymouth, Minnesota, to help us conduct this panel to make sure that we were not influencing any bias. We also contracted their professional moderator to help us. I'm not saying that I've ever been to prison, but I've seen some TV shows, and if you've ever seen that glass box, okay, that's what it felt like. We were interrogating. I was watching the consumers get interrogated and questioned about their preferences of beef. And there were several of us in that box, and we were really excited to be watching. So I'll share a little bit about our focus group outcomes. In regard to the design of this portion of the study, this was an unbalanced, randomized design with repeated measures. We used a subset of strip loins. We selected those based upon treatment average degree of marbling. What was unique kind of to this sensory analysis is that we had three different types of panels, okay? So the first panel was undisclosed with meat. That's pretty traditional, simply meaning that we're providing the meat product and we're asking folks to tell us their tenderness, juiciness, flavor, and we're asking them to deduct their preference of most preferred and least preferred. The second panel was disclosed without meat, okay? That's like you're shopping at the retail case and you see production information, but you're not eating the product. So we were attempting to emulate that. The third panel was both. Think of a high-end restaurant or a food service opportunity where you know information about what you're eating and you're assessing the palatability of that product. We had three flights. We had a total of 105 untrained consumer panelists, and they selected their most and least preferred, and that allowed us to determine the shares of preference. Okay, so I just shared with you that we gave them disclosed information. This was the disclosed information that we gave them. There's no national standard on being able to deduct the production system, so we did our best. But for example, here, raised without antibiotics was beef produced from cattle never receiving antibiotics, added hormones or other growth promoting products throughout their lifetime. The fourth treatment was beef produced from cattle that received growth promoting technologies, including antibiotics, antimicrobials, added hormones, and supplements to adjust fat to lean meat. These technologies were used to maintain animal health and improve productivity. So we'll come back to some of those, but after our panelists selected their most preferred steak, they went on to be asked what their willingness to pay was. We used a base price of $10.35, and we provided this image to them, which was a strip steak, okay, 12-ounce strip steak. Okay. The data that we collected was share of preference, the sensory attributes, their willingness to pay, and the final aspect of this study was ranking of novel labels. So we utilized the information that I shared with you earlier about claims and statements to do so. All right, so when we went to develop these claims and statements, what we did is we came up with a combination of 10 claims and statements to attempt to portray the outcomes of performance that we saw. So the environmental outcomes, some of the benefits of animal performance, and we took those combinations to DC and we sat with the labeling and program delivery staff and asked for their guidance to make sure that what we determined could actually be used in commerce, if so. And so once we had a few corrections, we then took those 10 combinations of claims and statements, and we did a 1,000-person nationwide survey to be able to reduce that combination to 5 claims and statements per treatment to try to improve the outcome of our data. And now I'm going to transition back into our consumer base, that persons who sat on this consumer panel, just to give you a little bit of background information about their demographics. We were pretty balanced in gender. We had a few more folks that were baby boomers. Majority of our consumers were light to medium beef eaters, meaning that they consume beef 1 to 4 times a week. So this is a table that represents the comparison of consumer preferences for beef from different production systems. And what you can see denoted here are those three panels. Again, gray bar is panel one. Again, that is just the product. The black bar is panel two, just the information. And the striped bar is both the information, which was provided first, followed by the product. And so then we went to denote their shares of preference. And just from a broad review here, you can see as we increased the utilization of growth hormone technologies, our preference went down. And that is not something that we hypothesized. We created the study and assumed that our consumers would not be able to detect a difference. Remember, I showed that there was a difference in tenderness, but that difference in tenderness was less than 4.4 kilograms of shear force by far. Okay. So this is just focusing on simply that information being provided. So think of those production descriptions, simply providing those. Here we can see that trend again very clearly. But I think what's really interesting and a little bit speaks to our hypothesis was that in our undisclosed with meat, okay, again, our first panel, what we found is that consumers preferred raised without antibiotics about 2% more than NHTC and implant, and there was no differences here between non-hormone treated and implanting successively three times. So that was more along the lines with our hypothesis, yet we can see implant plus beta agonist was still least preferred. Now, I think what's really exciting, because often when we do meat quality analyses and we do consumer work, we only give them the meat product. We don't try to decipher what actually that product is. And so this gave us the opportunity to do that. And we saw that when we provided this production description, that our consumer audience preferred NHTC about 10% more than NA. And so when we go back to look at NHTC and how this is written, beef produced with cattle that never received added hormones or supplements that adjust fat to lean meat, antibiotics and antimicrobials were used to maintain animal health and productivity, it seemed that our consumers could connect positively with this description. And we still see the consistencies, however, with implant and implant plus beta agonist when information is provided. So taking a step further to look at the demographics, when we're looking at the most preferred samples, thought this was interesting. Females in this study preferred NA 14% more than males, but males preferred NHTC about 12% more than females. So maybe there's an opportunity based upon demographics to market more appropriately. Okay. With the least preferred selections, interestingly, single households preferred implant 12% less than two-person households. Households with three or more persons did not differ. Maybe that is suggesting that households with more persons can see the benefits of efficiency technology, perhaps. Want to finish up here with the willingness to pay. There were no differences in willingness to pay, again, to that base of $10.35 for our panels one and two. But again, when we provided information with the product, we found that NHTC here was $1.05 more valued for a 12-ounce strip steak in comparison to implant. And then we saw that this is similar to our shares of preference. So again, willingness to pay followed our shares of preference, and this was followed with the second highest value of raised without antibiotics. So want to finish up on the claims and statements, and I've pulled out two treatments because it is a lot of words and a lot of description, but I'd just like to highlight the top two ranked combinations of claims and statements for raised without antibiotics, and then I'm also going to show you the implant treatment. So Here, the label claim raised without antibiotics and added growth promotants, with a corresponding statement of never administered antibiotics, added hormones, or other growth promotants was ranked highest here. A lot of negative marketing context going on there. Conscientiously raised, never administered antibiotics, added hormones, or other growth promotants was second highest in rank. And when we transition to implant and we begin to utilize some of those production efficiencies like we pulled from our data, you can see here, number two, some of that rose higher to the top of the scale. But what rose to number one was thoughtfully raised, antibiotics and growth promotants optimally used to maintain animal health and improve productivity. What we determined from the focus group is that they really like this language, optimally maintained animal health and improved productivity. That resonated really well with them. But we did see that they liked environmental friendly, raised with growth promoting technologies to reduce carbon footprint by 8% and water utilization here by 6%. The challenge, though, that they asked me to try to do a better job on was to try to have more tangible outcomes for those environmental improvements. So just to share with you some of the takeaways from the focus group, when we presented the word hormones, that was negatively perceived to cause early puberty, particularly growth promotants, perceived to cause unusual growth. Unfortunately, we've got to get better language on how we're going to talk about those terms. Consume less feed and water when we presented that to them. So simply more efficient, that was perceived as a producer benefit only. So got to get better at the efficiency language when we're talking to consumers. Positive resignations, as mentioned, used to maintain animal health and improve productivity. And also they were really receptive when we talked about optimization and judicious use of antibiotics. And I think that's really exciting because, as mentioned earlier in this presentation, that was a fast-growing meat market opportunity back in 2009 and 2012. And here we're seeing from this data that we can talk through customers about that. So in conclusion, consumers were able to detect differences in palatability. Okay, the beta agonist treatment was consistently less desirable for flavor and tenderness and had the lowest share of preference and willingness to pay. Consumers most preferred raised without antibiotics during the undisclosed with meat and disclosed without meat panels. However, when we provided information, we saw a 10% lift in that shares of preference, and we also saw that willingness to pay mirrored that result. Labels indicating judicious use of antibiotics and environmental conservation may have future industry application. Kind of a take home for this is we know that technologies are going to reduce our production costs. They're going to improve our on-farm efficiencies and our resource utilization. But we've got to continue to pursue consumer education and perception to still be using these technologies. So from this, what I perceive perhaps as some opportunities are targeting customers based upon demographics, ensuring that they're satisfied. The worst thing we can do is to provide a product to a customer that it may not be designed for and turn them away from beef. Next, market for the shared benefits of technology use for beef production and the environment. Perhaps there's an opportunity to focus on the benefit of genetic selection, which might give us some opportunity to work positively against some of the negative claims, or perhaps work on the growth promotant challenges that we see that we're facing in this data. Palatability and information does matter. Perhaps we should begin sharing information with our meat quality consumer analyses, ensuring that we market for optimization and the consumer benefit is really needed. Okay. And with that, I'd like to thank several collaborators, Dr. Rotz, Dr. Scaria, the experimental stations who were very assistive with this study, many support personnel too, funding support by the SDSU Experiment Station, as well as state and federal appropriated funds, and the Minnesota Beef Council for funding the consumer portion of the study. And with that, thank you very much. This is Dr. Blair and my contact information. If you have further questions, happy to entertain those now, or you can certainly contact us later on. So thank you.